I have a question. So, sort of about karma again, I guess. If there's certain teachings like the ones about karmic correlations that don't seem practical to me or don't seem commonsensical and aren't really applicable to my everyday life. And how do I think about them without sort of dissing them as being unimportant, or if other people ask me about them and say like, well, you know, this doesn't seem to make sense, and I kind of feel like saying, well, you know, that it doesn't really matter. It's not really, it won't really matter in your everyday life whether you're gonna, you know, be reincarnated in this area in your next life. It's not really what changes your life. How can I think about them in a way that's helpful?
Well, there's a, you know, piece of advice I've gotten from my teachers from long, long back, and that is that, you know, if there's some aspect of the Dharma that you don't understand, rather than diss it, you might want to just put it on a shelf for a while and, you know, kind of let it be without just, you know, kind of throwing it out until you've had a chance to really, really, you know, work it over in your mind and think about it. I was tempted to throw in some stuff about karmic correlations. I'm actually going to do a teaching in Singapore in just 2 weeks or so on a very important text from Arya Nagarjuna on karmic correlations. And I think it's possible to look at most karmic correlations, most of the lists that we have of karmic correlations in a rather in the kind of way I was talking about in the talk, as ways of thinking about changes of perception rather than changes in the world around you. For example, since it's the one that I took, and it's one of the ones that people sort of are like, you know, kind of interested in. How, you know, if I give, will I get more money? If I give money, will I get more money? And, you know, there's no guarantee that we'll get more money. You know, like even in the traditional teachings, as I was saying on karma, this lifetime, any time this lifetime, or the next lifetime, or any lifetime after that. And besides that, I don't think that's really the point. The point is to feel satisfied with the money that you do have. And that will come if you practice karma. And karma and the karmic cause of that is in a way the effect. The karmic cause of that is to say, look, I have enough money so that I can give. I can give happily, I can give, you know, without clinging, without selfish, you know, a selfish kind of assumption that I will be paid back in the future. So the practice of karmic causes in and of themselves are the practice of thinking that you've gotten the reward of karma. Virtue is its own reward. That's an old saying. And in that sense, you can look at the karmic correlations and see whether or not they aren't first of all really about perception rather than on changes in the, you know, in the outside world, in the external world, about the perception of your, you know, of your external world. And secondly, to see whether or not the karmic cause in the sort of cause and effect karmic correlation, you know, kind of a relationship doesn't have inherent in it the effect itself.
I'll think about it.
Yeah, me too. All right, thank you. Any more questions, Sonia?
Okay, no.
Okay, let's go to Reno. Blair, I'm not seeing any camera on you guys in Reno, just your mugshot there.
Yeah, hi, Lamaji. We turned off the camera because it was dark and we actually had a low turnout tonight. But we don't have any questions for you. We're all sitting here fat and happy and content and just kind of, you know, bobbling our heads going, yep. So we're good.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's nice to hear. Thanks for joining us tonight. And I'll see you guys soon this summer as well as the rest of you. Let's go to LA then.
Thanks, Lamaji.
Hi, Lamaji. I think on behalf of all seven of your Middle Way centers, I can say we're very grateful for this teaching, for you taking the time to put it together. My question has to do with what you said about the nature of the relationship between the student and the guru, as one that needs to become more egalitarian. I'm wondering if you see some pitfalls to that, because I know that a lot of the progress that I've seen my teachers go through and that I've gone through, and even Mahasukha as a center, have been because the guru has said, shut your mouth and do what I tell you to do. And I'm wondering about the letting go of that to take up this more egalitarian relationship. So that's my question.
Yeah, thank you, Alicia. It's a really good question. And as I sort of indicated in the talk, you know, I was even hesitant a little bit to open that Pandora's box about guru yoga, because it's a very, very deep and involved subject, I think. But I wasn't really suggesting that the teacher-student relationship be egalitarian. I was just saying that it's located in the context of an egalitarian society now, which is quite different from the authoritarian societies that relationship used to be found in. Any teacher-student relationship will, by definition, be unequal. You know, the teacher has something to teach you that you don't know, and so it starts like that. Of course, if it doesn't start, if you know as much as the teacher, then you don't really have a teacher. You see, if you're equal to the teacher in what they know, of course, you know, you may be quite superior to your teacher in all kinds of ways. You may know, you know, car mechanics, and the teacher doesn't. But the teacher, a spiritual teacher, is supposed to know something. You believe that the spiritual teacher knows something about the spiritual life that you don't know and that you need to know. So of course there's a built-in inequality like that. And then then the teaching begins. And sometimes part of the teaching is to shut your mouth and just do what you're told. That's a method in all forms of teaching. Like if, you know, you're learning piano or something like that, and you keep yabbering while you're supposed to be playing piano, your piano teacher might tell you to shut up and just play. You know, so it's part of the, you know, it's part of the teaching that sometimes that would be a useful ploy for the teacher to teach with. That I think is there's no substitute for that in an egalitarian society or in an authoritarian society. There's no substitute for the fact that you sit down and humble yourself and say, I need to know what you can teach me, please teach me. But in a context, in a modern context, where egalitarianism is the ideology, at least, if not the practice, okay? We can all be clear on that it's not always practiced, but it's the ideology that we're all sort of fundamentally equal. The spiritual teacher will find the relationship between a spiritual teacher takes its place within that context and not within an authoritarian context that we find in the pre-modern West, as well as in pre-modern Asia, and in monastic situations and so forth. So it doesn't change the idea that there is some kind of inequality when it comes to like a teacher knowing more than you do about a subject that you want to learn. But my point was just that doesn't in our commonsensical understanding of human relationships, that doesn't mean that person is somehow, kind of hardwired in general as someone superior to you. You know, there are inequalities all over the place. You know, like I said, you might know more about car mechanics. You might know how to put up a pup tent better than the spiritual teacher. Very, very, you know, obviously, right? Obvious kinds of inequalities, but when it comes to a spiritual life, if you're going to learn anything from a spiritual teacher, you have to assume that they have something to teach you that you don't know, and then you learn, you shut up and learn. But within the framework, within the kind of context, modern context I'm trying to avoid the word ontological egalitarianism. Which means that there's, you know, that we all are fundamentally at base equal, and that no human being it has some kind of like divine status that we don't all have. That's the context, I think.
Anyone else have a question here in law? So I'm going to keep my mouth shut and other people talk. Sit down. You're laughing, Lamaji, because you think that's an impossible mission.
I didn't say that. I was keeping my mouth shut.
I have my CD. I read your mind. Okay.
Hi, Lamaji. Thank you again for doing these teachings. It's very special to have you here virtually, if not in person. My question again is about karma. It seems to me that even karma as a perceptual viewpoint is difficult to take serious unless we talk about past and future lives. But then as soon as we start talking about past and future lives, then karma becomes a metaphysical standpoint too. So I'm wondering how we can take seriously this idea of a non-metaphysical view of karma when it seems there has to be something metaphysical going on and even to really take that viewpoint on.
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's Jed, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I figured he always asks like really good questions. The understanding of past and future lives that we ordinarily have is a metaphysical kind of understanding, and is probably inappropriate when it comes to why karma works and how it works. We don't know that there are past and future lives, and the very idea of past and future lives as we're normally thinking about it is, as you point out, a metaphysical concept and not a, if you want to use the sort of fancy philosophical terms, epistemological concept. That said, modern psychology and neurobiology, as well as our own practical experience, is pointing to the fact that we have plenty of past and future lives in this life, in this biological life, that in almost every fundamental way, we are not the same persons that we used to be when we were 5 years old, say, physically, mentally, in any other way. That the continuity that we overlay on what we call this life is just as artificial as the continuity that people used to label over the course of multiple lives as we understand them today. Kind of like from birth to death of the biological being. So I don't think it's necessary, it's obviously a very, very difficult question. There's no proof, fundamental proof, one way or the other, it seems to me, for past and future lives as we ordinarily think of them. But there's plenty of proof for past and future lives as if we think about them more in terms of what we call this life. And if that's the case, then it's possible to extend that understanding of how consciousness works, maybe over a larger framework than just the biological body. And that's one way of answering your question. The other way of answering your question is, well, how come we're born with the kind of genetic, DNA that we have? Why do all that stuff? And that also, I think, is some... Ultimately, if you push the question back, also answerable by karma in ways that modern science cannot answer it. Modern science eventually, if you push the why question, well, why was I born with that genetic makeup? And why do I have the parents that I did? And blah, 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 blah. Eventually, they throw their hands up in despair and just say, well, just because, And karma can answer that kind of question too. But increasingly, personally, I'm far less interested in past and future lives than I am in this one. And we got plenty to do here. we got plenty to keep us busy in this life rather than kind of spend too much time thinking about whether there are past and future lives in the way that we, usually and in a kind of a self-existent metaphysical fashion think about past and future lives, as if they were happening out there, you know, to somebody or something and so forth. And, you know, just kind of, for me, just, you know, concentrate on the changes that occur in this life and how are you going to deal with them, you know? How to deal with the fact that we're living, you know, kind of new lives on a moment-to-moment basis. Things begin, they last for a while, and then they end. And, you know, can we deal with that? And if we can deal with that, then we can deal with reality, at, you know, at all levels, I'd say. All right, any more in L.A.? Rick, come on.
Thank you.
You got something to say? I know.
I'm holding a computer and bailing the boat out. So anybody have a question? I think they have a lot to chew on.
Okay, good. Thank you all for coming, and thanks, Rick, for helping out so much and troubleshooting there.
You're very welcome. Thank you for great teaching.
Well, let's go to Marie Fowler's lounge room there in Melbourne. Marie, you got your sound on?
Yeah, we just put it on. We've got no questions.
Oh, actually, no, sorry. Ian's just popped in with a question. Sorry. Thank you so
okay,
much.
Okay, hi. Hi, Dr. Ian. Can you just speak into the microphone so I can hear you?
Yeah, where is it?
Oh, no.
Okay. How are you, Lamarick? Thank you very much. My question is, once again, about karma. Sorry about that. When we say we have a certain karma, or we collect karma, or this is my karma, who is it? Given that there is no real self, who has the karma? Is that that's just awareness, or that is consciousness, or is that how we look at it?
Yeah, that's an ancient million-dollar question. It was million-dollar question 2,500 years ago, when the Buddha first said that there was simultaneously no self and karma that extends through the continuity of a no self, and it's a million-dollar question today. Here's my best understanding of this. Okay, it's not that we have karma. There's no me that has karma. I am karma. I am karma. There's no me that has karma. So our self-conception is karma. The way we think about who we are is karma. And so we think about who we are because of who we think we have once been. Part of our self-identity at any moment in the ongoing present is a large part. You could even say the whole of it. Is constituted by who I think I was, by memory, in other words. You know, if you can kind of do a little thought experiment, you know, and they've done some clinical sort of studies of people who absolutely lose memory, and they have no self, basically. There's no self to somebody who has no memory. It's just impossible to even think of who you would be without memory. So that's another way of talking about karma. We are who we think we once were. We are who we think we have been, and that defines our present, and we will be who we are today. In other words, everything that we do, say, and think in our present is planting seeds for a future self-conception. So, you know, if you're a good person, you know, at least trying to be a good person, you will think of yourself differently in the future because you will have given yourself new memories. If you think of yourself as a bad person, you will have gifted yourself with different kinds of memories in the future, if you see what I mean. But there's no karma apart from the self-conception. Karma and self-conception are the same thing, in a way, you could say. But our self-conception is definitely changing and definitely changeable. We can mold our self-conception. But that's the only self that exists, is a conception of the self, an idea of the self, a conceptualization of the self. There isn't a self apart from the idea of the self. And that I have learned sort of fairly recently is, you know, is the findings of neurobiology and modern psychology as well. There's no control center. There's no integrated control center that they can find, you know, in the biological brain, neurobiology, and there's no control center according to psychology either. The self is a conception of the self, and Buddhism has sort of been saying that for a long, long time. Did that get at your question?
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Okay, guys, thanks for coming in, Melbourne.
Thank you. Thanks.
Singapore? JJ, you got any questions for me?
We know everything, Namaji. We know everything already, so thank you.
That's a good attitude.
No, Lamaji, you answered many of the questions we had. That's the good thing about going last. So a lot of stuff was cleared up.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you guys for showing up early in the morning over there. And I look forward to seeing the people in Melbourne and Singapore very shortly and being with you in person. And seeing the people in the U.S. In July and August in person again, and we'll have a chance to, you know, carry on some of these conversations, hopefully in person. And I'm very grateful to all of you for participating in this adventure, in this experiment, you could say, this three-part experiment on the internet. I know it wasn't optimal in a lot of ways, but, you know, we did it, and it worked, And I'm very appreciative for you for your patience and attendance in these talks, and to the people like David and Rick Liu who work so hard to technologically make it all happen. So thank you very much. I'll be signing off now, I guess, unless anybody's got any real pressing question.
We do another last shot.
Yeah, we have one last shot, David.
We had one more technical issue that we needed to work out. It needs to start in Australia, though, I think. Australia, can you check your mic? Make sure you have it on.
Okay.
Happy birthday to you.
Thank you, everyone. The intention was far greater, bigger than the actual event. So, thanks for giving it your college go.
Thank you, Lamaji.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. That's a lot of candles.
Good job, guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you,
David.
All right.
Thank you, David. This worked really well, other than our camera exploding.
Well, we'll see y'all later. Oh, look at that cake. Oh, wait. Look at that cake.
Hey, David.
Hey.
David, can you hear us?
Yeah.
Kelly has a question here for you in the Nashville group.
Sure.
It's for the young lady who asked the question.
Is it for me?
I can't see anymore. Hi.
Hi.
We have a youth group. I don't know. How old are you?
17.
Okay, we have a teen youth group called Peace In, Peace Out that we have in LA. It's on Mondays and Sundays, and you're welcome to Skype in with us. We'll figure it out.
Oh, cool.
I'll get the email to the Tennessee.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay,
cool. Great. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good question.
Thank you.
Let's have another look at that cake.
Well, part of it is on the floor here already. So.
Okay, David, I think it worked well. I mean, other than it looked like a Sergio Leone movie out of sync. But the audio never went away, and
you know,
it worked really well.
You know what?
Thank you very much.
You know what? I think it would have worked fine for him to do it live. I think he did the pre-recording just to be safe. But I think I think it would have been fine to do live. Everything was great live.
Yeah. Cool. Onward and upward.
Yeah.
Well, we have to do set up for salsa dancing here in the center. So.
Oh, we'll leave it on then. That's what we want to see.
That's the subscription channel. Okay, guys.
Thank y'all.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Awesome. Bye, Angie. Awesome.
I should put my knee in the
All right, let's eat some cake.
Oh, it's on the ground.
Good job, guys. Thank y'all.
Good job, David. Thank you.
Wow. It's amazing you stayed on the cardboard.